gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Dr. Kimberly Wintemute. Dr. Wintemute practiced emergency medicine for the first 6 years of her career, was appointed medical director of the North York Family Health Team in 2008, and in 2014 was named Regional Family Physician of the Year by the Ontario College of Family Physicians. Heather and I had the pleasure of having lunch with Kimberly a couple of weeks ago when she came to our service. I discovered that not only do we share a strong sense of social justice, but a passion for choral music, too. It turns out that Kimberly sings in the choir at St. James Cathedral. And what I quickly discovered during our conversation is how fortunate Kimberly's patients are. She is a warm and caring doctor with a mind for problem solving and that strong passion for social justice. Welcome, Dr. Wintemute.
Thanks, Kathy, and thank you for having me here today to talk about the relationship between poverty and health, and also perhaps to talk about how we can bring our community narrative and our concerns to a place where they might be translated into social policy. So I have to say I'm suffering a little imposter syndrome because I'm not the expert on poverty and health, and there are people at St. Michael's Hospital who spend their days researching this question. One of them is collaborating with us at North York Family Health Team. But one of my colleagues recently called me the queen of cold calls because I'm not afraid to just make a call or put myself out there when I think that the message is really important, and that's kind of how I got here today. So I listen to Metro Morning on CBC Radio with regularity, and Matt Galloway often features stories about social justice. And when we were putting together our pilot project for targeted poverty screening at North York Family Health Team, I thought Matt might be interested in our project. So I sent an email to Metro Morning, and it was about 10 months later I got a response from one of his producers saying, yes, we want to feature you. And I landed up having some airtime in December. And I understand that Kevin from your congregation heard me on the radio. And that's how I got here. So cold calling and getting our voices out there is a really good thing. So if I could just ask you to advance the slide, that would be great. So the connection between poverty and health is very strong, and the World Health Organization reminds us that poverty is the single greatest determinant of health. So poverty leads to illness, and illness also leads to poverty. And I'm going to help you to deconstruct this slide because it's a bit busy and a bit kind of academic looking. So it's a bar graph, and what we see in the height of those bars are death rates. So those are, it's called age-adjusted mortality rates or death rates for different diseases. And then you'll see going from left to right, the left cluster is people who have HIV or AIDS, and then the next one is diabetes. The next one is COPD, which is lung disease primarily from smoking, and then suicide. And then we have all-cause death rate from all causes, and then malignancy. And then the colors of those bars represent the income quintiles in Canada. So when we fill out our census, the government collects information about our income, and they divide us into five groups. So the dark blue bar are the poorest people, and the yellow bar are the wealthiest Canadians. And so you can see for each disease that's represented there that there's a gradient of health. So at any given age, poor people are more likely to die from a chronic disease than rich people. And the other thing that you can see there is that there's no real, you know, it's a real gradient. It's gradual. There's no income cutoff above which people would be guaranteed to have greater life expectancy and below which, you know, people would be less healthy. It's really a very gradual relationship. So what do we know about poverty in Ontario? We know that in the last decade, income inequality has increased in Ontario, so the gap is getting wider between rich and poor. About 12% of Ontarians live below the poverty line, and we know that within that, single females and their children are the greatest group in terms of representation. We know that people who are not white and people who are indigenous are more likely to be living in poverty as well. The other thing we know is that poverty is moving out of the downtown core and it's moving to the suburbs, which presents special challenges that Vicky and I were talking about earlier. It's hard to look after people in the suburbs because the distances between social services are so great, and people really need a car in the suburbs, which is something that most people living in poverty cannot afford. So could you advance the slide, please? So this is just, I just want to show you that Ontario is divided into 14 health regions. They're called LHINs, or Local Health Integration Network. And so those are the color-coded LHINs. And then if you advance the slide again, this is my LHIN, where North York General and North York Family Health Team are. It's called Central LHIN, and that water mass on the bottom is Lake Ontario, and the largest water mass on the top is Lake Simcoe. So our LHIN kind of goes north of 401 and spans out up to Lake Simcoe. And then what you see in the color coding there are the percentage of households living in poverty. So the light pink is less than about 7%. That's York region. So, you know, even though Torontonians like to make jokes about people who live in Thornhill, people in York region actually have the longest life expectancy in Canada, okay, and low rates of poverty. But the darker colors and the dark maroon represents areas where over 17% of the households live in poverty, so very densely represented. And so I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure of some of those communities. So that would include places like Jane and Finch, and the kind of Dufferin and Finch, Dufferin and Steeles corridor, which has become highly ghettoized in the last couple of decades. So if you see a condo building going up in Toronto today, you'll see a beautiful building going up, and then on the street level, you're going to see a grocery store, an LCBO, and usually a bank. And an architect friend of mine told me not too long ago that those three services are considered the holy trinity that's required to sell those condo suites, if you have the liquor store and the bank and the groceries. And so we have mixed residential and then commercial zoning so that the people who live in those places have services that they can access. Well, places like Jane and Finch were not deliberately engineered. And so the infrastructure of those areas actually perpetuates the poor health of the poor community who lives there. So if you live at Jane and Finch, it's not very likely that you can walk to a grocery store to get fresh produce. It's more likely you'll be able to walk to a variety store to get a chocolate bar or a bag of chips. The other thing about those neighborhoods is that there's a lot of crime. So there are thugs who intimidate and who steal. And you know, because they're poor and because they lack hope. And so even if you wanted to get out for a walk, the people in those neighborhoods can't go out for a walk because it's not safe. So if I have a patient who lives there with diabetes, it's not hard to imagine that that person has a really hard time controlling their diabetes because of all of those factors. They cannot get out for a brisk 30-minute walk every night after dinner. It's just not happening. And then factor in that we live in a city where red Skittles are cheaper than red peppers, and you'll understand why it is so hard for those people to manage their chronic disease. I just want to remind people that poverty can be visible and poverty can be invisible. So if you went last night down to King Street to see a show and maybe out for dinner, you know, one of these very privileged activities that we are able to take part in, you might have noticed some people panhandling on the street, and those people are the visible poor. But you might not have considered that the waiter or the waitress who was serving you at the restaurant might be living below the poverty line. And people who live in those who work in those kind of frontline jobs often do live below the poverty line. They're often holding together a couple of jobs, or they're a student with a job with a high debt load. So we don't often know who's poor, and that's why in family medicine, that's why we need to ask the question. So there's been quite a lot of research in Canada, primarily in BC and in Toronto, around how do we screen for poverty in family medicine? What question should we ask? And it turns out that this is the validated question that we can ask that gives an answer that really does often correspond to whether that person's living above or below the poverty line. So it's a very simple question. At the end of the month, do you ever have trouble making ends meet? And then when people answer the question, if the answer is yes, we ask them a couple other questions which can help us understand how to help that person. So, you know, I work in North York, and it's the population is quite broad from a socioeconomic standpoint. And so we thought, you know, if we ask everyone this question, the yield won't be that high. So how can we maybe target our screening so that we can find people who are struggling a little easier? Thanks. And we're doing targeted poverty screening. So I'm going to explain what we've done. We've merged two databases. So in our family health team, we have electronic records. So most of you now, when you go to the doctor, your doctor is probably on a computer, and that's your chart. It's no longer paper. And those computer charts are a wealth of data. And so, you know, we realized almost all the patients have a postal code. And then we also realized that Stats Canada has information that links postal codes to the income quintiles. So Stats Canada can tell you for any given postal code what's the average income in that area. So we thought if we identified the postal codes with the lowest incomes, average incomes, and then we applied a reminder into the electronic record of those patients who lived in those postal code areas, maybe the yield of the question will be higher. So we put a reminder in their chart. In all those electronic charts, there's this little reminder section. So if you haven't had a tetanus shot in over 10 years, it's going to flag that, you know, this patient's due for tetanus. So if you come in for any other reason, I can say, oh, you know, we should update your tetanus. And so what we did was we put a little reminder call, and we just said SES screen, which means socioeconomic status screen. And that would prompt the clinician, whether it was the family doctor or one of our social workers or our nurse practitioner, to ask that question next time the patient comes in. So we did this as a little pilot. We just tried it for 3 months, and I'm going to talk about our data. And we're now at the point where we want to expand it to all 85 physician practices in our family health team. So the data that we have, the denominator was about 4,000 patients, and of that 4,000, we flagged only the adult charts. Obviously, we weren't going to ask the children the questions. And there were 157 charts out of 4,000 that were living in those high-risk areas. And over 3 months, 49 of those people came into the doctor for any reason, and 12 of them said, yes, they were having trouble making ends meet, and they went to see our caseworker. So almost a 25% kind of capture rate, 12 out of 49 people, which is about double the provincial, the known number for how many people are living in poverty. So, and 8 people over that time actually saw the caseworker, and we did a patient experience survey to see what it was like for those people, and it was really overwhelmingly positive. So we're in expansion mode. So I want to talk a little bit about what we can do in family medicine around poverty. And if there are family practices that aren't screening for poverty, it's not because they don't care. It's because they don't know what to do with the answer. And some of them also aren't as fortunate as family health teams to have social workers and caseworkers who can actually help move the process forward. So the first thing we can do is link people to income supports. So sometimes people qualify for provincial or federal income supports. They don't know about it. So if someone has lung disease from smoking and it's very advanced and they need a scooter, well, there's a program called the Assistive Devices Program that will help that person to buy the scooter if they're living below a certain income level. So we can help people access things like that. We can also help connect people to community services, so single moms, connecting them to Ontario Early Years Centers where they can network with other moms. We can do individual advocacy. So I have one patient who has psychotic illness, and when it's well controlled, that person is able to work and be a productive member of society, and there's one medication that controls that mental illness for this patient, and it is not covered by the government program that helps the working poor. And this person cannot afford to buy the medication. So every 6 months, I reapply to the pharmaceutical company. So we always think bad things about Big Pharma, but they often do have programs. And I rewrite the same letter. Could we please have a compassionate supply of this medication for another 6 months? And they do it. And that person's been surviving on a compassionate supply for 10 years. So it's a good service. The other thing we can do is we can design our practices equitably. So, you know, I can think of another single mom in my practice living in poverty on Ontario Works, but also with a part-time job and kind of trying to advance herself. The kids are in two different places, one's in daycare and one's at school. And it is really hard for that person to get to my office on time. So if the appointment is at 1:30, my front staff now know to leave me an open spot at 2:30 because that might be around the time that she'll show up. And you know, the other thing that the whole office now knows is to welcome that person when they come in, to not approach them punitively. They're not trying to be disrespectful by being late. They just are struggling. And some days they don't have a subway token. Some days they don't have any other support to go get the other child. So we can just kind of open our hearts and be forgiving when that person arrives. So I want to turn a little bit to the economic costs of poverty. So, you know, we usually think of poverty as some kind of economic deprivation, but actually poverty is an expense to our society. And it's one of the biggest burdens on the economic, the healthcare, and the criminal justice system in Canada. So in terms of economics, so, you know, people who aren't working, the productivity is lost, there's lost tax revenue, and there's the paying out of social assistance benefits and affordable housing, things like that. In terms of healthcare, there's more chronic disease in poor populations, higher mortality rates, as we saw, and more use of the healthcare system. So many more points of contact for poor people than for people who are better off. And then socially, we you know, the cost to us is crime, and also more interaction with the criminal justice system, and more people actually incarcerated when there's more poverty. And there have been several documents in the last few years that have done economic analyses of poverty. And so this first point about Toronto. So Toronto spends about $5 billion a year to look after poverty. And that's from John Stapleton's report just from November 2016. He's a social policy expert who wrote a really good report. In Ontario, we spend between $32 and $38 billion per year. That's about 6% of GDP. Child poverty in Ontario apparently accounts for between $4 and $6 billion per year. And in 2011, the Canadian government put $25 billion to the provinces just to look after the problems associated with poverty. So in BC recently, and this is perhaps more inspiring, they did an economic analysis of what it would take to enact a poverty reduction strategy. And so they estimated that it would cost BC $3 to $4 billion per year, which when you compare it to what we're already spending is actually not that much. And so as John Stapleton says, I'll just ask you to turn to the next slide, in his report, investing in poverty prevention would be less costly in the long run than spending to marginally mitigate ongoing poverty in perpetuity, which is kind of what we've been doing so far. So I want to get to the point about what we can do, because I think we have a lot of reasons to be hopeful. And how we can maybe bring our voices to a place where our community leaders might translate this into social policy. So, you know, over the course of my life, I've been to a lot of religious services of different kinds. And I grew up in the United Church, and then I was drawn to Anglicanism, which was my father's family's church. And then I was married for 14 years to someone who was Jewish, and I went to a lot of Reform and Conservative Jewish synagogue services. And in the last couple years, I've been to a few Catholic services because as the medical assistance in dying legislation was coming forward, I was really interested to hear the messaging in the Catholic Church. So one of the things I've noticed is there's a commonality in these services, and that commonality is that we pray for our civic leaders. And In fact, in the Christian Bible, we are commanded to pray for our government leaders in several parts of the Bible, but maybe most notably in one of the letters that Paul wrote to Timothy. And, you know, I think that's wonderful. I think I commend our civic leaders for putting themselves out there and putting themselves on the line. They're so exposed, and they do such difficult work. But I would submit that they need more than our prayers. I think that they need our guidance, they need our direction, and one of the things, you know, when we vote for them, we're essentially hiring them. We're hiring them to work for us. So I was curious to know how many people here are employers who employ other people. Are there any employers? Yeah. So do you interview people before you hire them? And do you, you know, when they're a little off course, do you give them feedback and course correction and things like that? So I think that our civic leaders need a little more of that. And we are coming up to a pre-election year in Ontario. And so the time is ripe to let them know what's on our minds and to interview them a little bit about, you know, what they could possibly do for us. How could we interview the people who are running to be the next civic leaders in Ontario? So there will be candidates debates locally, as there always are. And so what I've done with a couple of people at St. James, so Sharon Danley, who is a social justice advocate, and Mary Drews, who's one of the other people in the choir there, we sat down one day and we devised four questions that could be asked to people running for civic leadership around poverty. And I have 40 copies of this, if anyone would like to take one home after. And I can also send the Word document to Kathy. So the first question is about child poverty. So it goes like this. It is known that child poverty is a root cause of poverty, and that Toronto has more children living in poverty than any other city in Canada. Please outline your commitment to addressing child poverty in Ontario in the next 4 years. The next question would be about health and poverty. We know that poverty is a risk factor for diseases like diabetes and heart disease. Ontarians living in poverty use the healthcare system more often than others, and they have higher death rates from all causes. Describe the changes that you will make to reduce the differences in income that perpetuate differences in life expectancy among Ontarians. The next question talks about mental health. Ontario has fragmented and insufficient services for mental health care. Please tell us your plans and your timeline for addressing this mental health crisis should you be elected. And then finally, several economic analyses outline the societal costs of poverty. They consistently show that investing in poverty reduction saves money in the long run, in addition to giving people dignity. What will you do to help move government spending on poverty toward prevention rather than treatment? So it's my hope that we could fan out, that we could go in groups, that we could ask consistent, well-formed questions to people who are running for civic office at any level. And if we know people from other socially concerned congregations, share the questions with them and share the responses so that we all know, you know, which candidates are giving what responses. And, you know, we all know that when one person speaks up, someone else finds the courage to speak up. And when voices start to echo and a message starts to snowball, those are the times when a really loud voice can emerge and we can end up changing social policy. So if you consider, for example, the medical assistance in dying legislation that was passed last year, that didn't come from nowhere. That came from the baby boomers. That was a baby boomers narrative, and Justin Trudeau knew that the boomers would not rest until that was put into legislation. And that was many years of collective voices that put that into place. And, you know, the other kind of modern thing going on is truth and reconciliation. So, again, years of voices of outrage and disbelief at what was going on in the Indigenous community in Canada have led to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So it takes many voices. And, you know, I think for the most part in this room today, we are people of privilege. And we have good things to say, and I really hope that we can get our voices out there. Because we come with voices that speak of compassion and inclusivity, voices that reflect teamwork and a regard for the collective good, voices that call for proactive rather than reactive social change, voices that call for thoughtful planning rather than scrambling to repair things, and voices that call for things like employment and a living wage, things that uphold dignity, you know, rather than lineups at the food bank where really only lowliness can prevail. So I think we should go and we should ask our current and potential leaders to start to address some of the root causes of poverty, many of which are well known and understood. Because with poverty, just like with health, the best strategy is prevention. Thanks.